Well, this is a transcript of an international webcast that Linda LaRouche gave from Washington, D.C. on March 7th, where he outlined the implications of the Gore hoax on international policy. Because the issue here, politically, with Gore, and the reason we're saying global warming, what Gore is presenting as global warming is a hoax, is not because we disagree with the fact that the temperature of the planet is changing, or there's a fluctuation in the amount of CO2 emissions that are being produced into the atmosphere, and things of that nature. We're not trying to deny the fact that there's climate change, but what we're saying is that unless people begin to think as scientists and no longer continue to tolerate popular opinion as their primary source of identity, really, and the way in which they think, we're going to become vulnerable to the type of implications that the acceptance of this global warming hoax has on our planet. Because what Pascal was going through is the main feature of this discussion that Lyndon LaRouche took up in Washington, D.C., where first and foremost he outlined the fact that we're in a disintegration process of the international financial system. And to get a sense of that, if you look at what's happening in the United States right now, we've been deindustrialized as a nation through free trade and globalization. And the implications of that are the foundation of the American economy was built primarily before and after World War II on the policies that came in with the Roosevelt administration, the New Deal, the policy of development through infrastructure, but also the government policies to have the economy and trade regulated by federal standards and agreements among nations, to have a monetary policy that was based on mutual agreement upon a fixed exchange rate among nations, meaning a dollar with a relatively fixed value. And what we've had over the past, since 1971, where the Bretton Woods system was taken down, a series of policies that have been passed through the United States of taking this system down, of deregulating the industries of the United States, deregulation of the banking system to allow free market speculation, and most viciously, free trade and outsourcing as a national and international economic policy. What we've seen over the past 30 years is the value of the U.S. dollar, which after World War II became the denominated currency of the world financial system because it was the only currency that had any value. The rest of the world was bankrupt. And the Bretton Woods system was established upon a fixed exchange rate with the U.S. Currency being the nominal currency of world trade. And what we've had under this policy of free trade, which is the primary dogma of today's economic department in universities and globalization, what we've had is a policy that has intentionally targeted investment in industry and scientific and technological orientation. So, keep in mind also, Is there anyone who is American here, who like lives in the United States or grew up there, was born there? Okay. Well, there's something important that you have to understand about the American constitutional system of government. We don't operate under economically. From a political economic standpoint, the United States does not operate under a monetary system. What we have constitutionally is a credit system. And this is defined in the U.S. Federal Constitution, that the House of Representatives has the power to generate and issue credit. It's part of the balance of powers within the federal government. The House of Representatives has the authority to have a monopoly over currency. So, for example...
The House of Representatives would be the Senate?
No, that would be the House.
The Congress is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
There's the
House of Representatives, then there's the Senate, and the House has the authority to say, for example, if there's a policy, large scale policy, or even take it from this standpoint, or look at it from a recent report that Lyndon LaRouche wrote, in terms of the perspective of large-scale, long-term development. What he was talking about in January 2007 at a similar event in Washington, D.C., after he had just written a report at request from some officials inside the U.S. Senate on a capital budget. Lyndon LaRouche was attempting to educate the new Congress that had just come in post-November on the principles of economic policy. And he started with the conception that it's going to be necessary to establish a capital budget for the type of investment necessary to rebuild the U.S. economy. And this is a separate budget. It's a separate accounting budget than the annual fiscal government budget. This is a budget which deals with a larger capacity of investment credit extended for a longer period of time. Because if you're talking about building power systems, or even the simple challenge, that's kind of an ironic statement, of repairing our collapsed infrastructure today, you're going to need a heavy load of investment and credit and resources. And these kind of things, the large-scale infrastructure projects don't just grow overnight. You're talking about recruiting and educating a skilled labor force. You're talking about physical conditionalities that have to be taken into consideration in terms of what direction you're taking a certain policy. Because if you're talking about repairing the locks and dams and the rivers, you want to make sure that the work that's done and the resources that are utilized to replace the current locks and dams are going to be of a higher quality with a better efficiency and better productive capacity. So these kind of things obviously take a larger amount of time to begin to develop wealth for the society. But they're also necessary forms of investment. Same thing with the power system. It may take about 8 years or so to bring a nuclear power plant online. But after these 8 years, the benefit of electricity distribution for powering commerce and industry has a larger return in the long run than the initial investment. We've seen this with the Kennedy space mission. It's a primary example. But these kind of things can't simply be managed on a year-to-year basis. You have to have a longer-term perspective. So this is something that is politically and culturally distinct about the United States. The fact that we have a system of government in which we're not subject to any outside banking system or arbitrary financial system in general. We have the power and authority to produce and create credit, issue credit, in the name of the federal government for specific purposes of development. Most people don't understand that today. And that idea is not employed in policy shaping. But in any case, it's that kind of idea that established a international financial system. That's what gave the U.S. dollar the credit and the value that other nations around the world agreed to a fixed exchange rate based on. It wasn't some arbitrary nominal value that was given to the dollar based on things like supply and demand. But it was the underlying substance of the physical economic capacity to produce and provide for the population that gave bankrupt Europe the trust in the United States to say, we agree to this system. So that's something to keep in mind, because today we don't have any we don't have that kind of economic value today. What has become the replacement of that kind of economy is like what Pascal was going through with the real estate market, and how these things become major centers of investment. We used to invest in steel manufacturing, or companies that were doing something good for society, like producing washing machines or lawnmowers. You could, honest workers would put their stock in a country because they agreed with the philosophy of the company. They wanted to invest in the company because it was doing something good for society, and they would be able to have a security that they would be able to claim to put their child through college, perhaps to buy a house or an automobile, those kind of things. No longer does that kind of investment available to the average operative in the economy, because the financial markets have been dominated by larger financial institutions like hedge funds. And it's important to know that Al Gore runs a hedge fund. Al Gore runs a hedge fund out of London. And the name is rightfully called, for the sake of exposing a little bit about the character of this fellow, Blood and Gore. It's actually called Generation Investment Management, but it was set up by Al Gore and a guy named David Blood. But what this hedge fund specializes in is the trade of carbon credit. So, here's a scenario. Since what we're going to do with Ecuador is according to the laws of, say, for, I'm not sure the whole details behind what this Kyoto Agreement was, but I'm thinking, if I'm correct, that there's a certain amount of emissions of carbon dioxide that can be produced into the atmosphere, given a certain level of industrial development. So, what blood and gore specializes in is, say, for example, the United States. We're producing too much carbon. We're producing beyond the amount of carbons that have been prescribed by Kyoto. What we can do is we can go to Ecuador and we can say, this is what we're going to do. We're going to come to this agreement. We're here to help you out. We want to continue to maintain our industries. And we also want to do something good for your nation. So what we're going to do is we're going to buy the excess carbon credit that you're not using because you're underdeveloped. And we're going to give you money in exchange for your carbon credit so that we can continue to produce and without downsizing our industries or reducing our labor force. And you're also going to benefit because we're giving you money. Now, just to mention, I don't know, you can extrapolate this concept in your own mind, but in my mind, I don't see any long-term security in that kind of economic trade policy. Money for carbon credit.
So in other words, industrialized country will be allowed to continue with this industry by buying carbon credit from a country that is underdeveloped and is not producing as much carbon.
Yeah, they can do, they can. That's
But with the money that they get, they can really only import goods. They can't actually produce their own because then they would lose that carbon credit.
I'm not sure of the conditionality.
They just can't put that money towards development.
Well, I mean, if Ecuador goes and takes the money they get from carbon credit and put it into a factory, what happens to the carbon credit, man? It goes out the window.
Oh, man.
Actually, it doesn't go out the window. It's like, there's a certain basic amount of carbon that you can have allowed to produce, every country can do. Say it's 15, I have 15, you have 15. If you go above 15, and then you buy mines, and then I can't, once you buy it, that's when I'm done. I can't use them. You own them.
Right.
So what do you do with the money?
Or for a year?
For that period.
Mm-hmm. 5-year carbon credit.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. So you go up 5, you can take my 5, and then I'm stuck at 10. And you have 20.
I have 20.
Yeah.
So I go and build a bunch more factories, and then 20 years later, or whatever, at the end of the contracts, my factory's going full steam, and I'm like out of carbon credits now, and I shut down the factory, I guess.
That's if you get there.
Yeah.
And then you buy it. It's one of those.
It's a game.
Then maybe I don't know, who knows, you could use some of the, you can use what you didn't spend on the factory to buy Kenya's carbon swap.
Yeah.
Actually, we got a funny, I'll show you something really funny. See, the thing with this hedge fund,
How do you spell hedge?
Hedge fund. Like you're going to use this fund to hedge your bets on the financial markets. The thing about this hedge fund, blood and gore, is that it's specializing in these carbon swaps. And what is being used right now, like for example, George Bush was just down in Mexico and South America 2 weeks ago, and I don't know what happened to George Bush. All of a sudden, maybe he was reborn again over the new year, because all of a sudden he gives a State of the Union address in January, and he's become this great environmentalist. He's talking about the ethanol economy, using biofuels as the next generation of power. So he went down to South America for a tour to meet with presidents and business leaders, discussing the hopes for a future perspective of an ethanol biofuel economy. But what they're attempting to do is they're using this biofuel. They're trying to direct the development of biofuels into creating a new financial center for investment. It's not really about the function that this fuel source is going to play as part of contributing to an increase in the power of any economic system. And actually, we have some EIRs that report the fact that they don't even do that. It takes more. The production of these biofuels consumes more energy than they're able to generate. So this thing is being used to open up new markets for financial speculation. So we made a series of funny cartoons that kind of give people an example of what this carbon swap business is all about.
That's beautiful.
Who's the woman in the trash can?
That's Tibber Gore.
Tibber is his wife?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, he's chucked her out.
Yeah, carbon swap.
I mean, if you hate humans, you must hate your wife too.
You swap carbon.
Yeah. It's a nice stack of coal, huh? Got the curves.
It's very sinister, this whole thing. It's almost like it runs on ideas that are deliberately wasteful.
Well, yeah, because generally what Pascal was going through, like, culturally and intellectually, the baby boomer generation just really doesn't have the passion to live for any serious historic ideas. And what they've become vulnerable to are these kind of this kind of economic system, which doesn't really function under any principles. Like, this whole idea of deregulation was that we're going to take the regulations down in the banking system to allow for new forms of financial investment. They say, well, hey, you know, that sounds good. It may bring some wealth to our economic system. Why not? Or the worst thing that we've been doing recently is privatizing infrastructure. Like, for example, states in the U.S. are going bankrupt, and even in Europe. And what we've been doing is we've been selling our infrastructure to holding companies and banks, leasing them out for like 99 years. In the case of the Chicago,
like Hong Kong,
the Chicago Skyway,
what,
yeah,
Hong Kong?
British leased Hong Kong for 99 years. They did.
Yeah, I remember. And then they handed it over to China.
Yeah, well, they had to.
Yeah, well, these kind of things. Who's?
I don't think China wanted to.
Where's the guarantee now that the maintenance of this bridge is going to be there when it's required? Who's the guarantee that the water management systems, like in Argentina, water management systems have been privatized since the 1970s? The same thing in Chile. We ran a big campaign exposing this when George W. Bush came out in 2004 saying that he was going to privatize Social Security. we dug up a series of materials that we had produced going back about 20, 25 years, showing that the same privatization scheme that George W. Bush is talking about is the exact same model that was used under the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet in Chile. And the policy is being run by the same character who orchestrated that, George Shultz, who is the mastermind behind the Bush administration now, the guy who composed the first cabinet of George W. Bush, who advised George Bush in his gubernatorial campaign in 1988 in Texas. The same George Shultz who controls Arnold Schwarzenegger in California. The same George Shultz who controls the policy of Cheney and Condoleezza Rice. Same George Shultz in the Nixon administration who worked with Henry Kissinger and Felix Roatan to run Operation Condor, the death squads in Chile. And then it was George Shultz's friends from the Chicago University Economics Department that came in to advise the Pinochet government on the privatization of the entire social welfare system of Chile. It was destroyed. It was looted. And this is these. Where's the principles of involved here? What kind of economic system are you in that would allow for this kind of monopoly, where governments become secondary?
What is this Shultz guy getting out of this? Like, is he getting money, and how much money does he need to be happy? Like, what's the deal with this guy?
Well, Shultz right now is this discussion of the military privatization. He's involved in that too, with Felix Roatan. Well, he formerly, in the Carter administration, in the Nixon administration, and in the Reagan administration, he was in the Defense Department. He was Secretary of Defense under Jimmy Carter, I think, or maybe I could be getting it mixed up. But between the Carter and the Nixon administration, he was Secretary of Defense and the Treasury Secretary. He's continued to play a role in the political establishment in the United States. But what George Shultz and Henry Kissinger believe philosophically that the nation-state system is over. We're in a post-nation-state system. The Treaty of Westphalia is no longer a valid principle of international law. We're in a post-nation-state system where globalization is primary is our economic system, and they've got economists and lackeys in universities who teach this stuff. Like, we talk to economic students, and they're hysterical, saying, "Well, we've naturally evolved into a globalized world economy. It's a natural evolution of the world economic system. We're in a globalized world now." But the underlying intention of where this policy comes from is to eliminate the nation state, in particular the United States. And that's why this Gore thing is dangerous. That's why it's dangerous waters here, fighting out what is the real issue of our beef with Al Gore. Because, like I said earlier, the tit for tat on the details of the climate change are not so important when you realize that we're in a financial collapse, and that this war policy of the Bush administration, not just toward Iran, but also Syria, potentially with Russia, same thing coming out of Great Britain toward China. This is globalization. This is the nature of the political economic system that is unraveling right now. So the big fight with Al Gore is key, because in November 2006, our youth movement was critical in bringing something in called the New Politics, where we changed the structure of the U.S. Federal Congress. We got a Democratic majority in the election in November. And that brought in a whole new cast of personalities into the U.S. Congress. Many of them are not your typical career politicians. Many of them actually gained support from their constituents because they were very, very, they wouldn't budge in terms of changing their line on the Iraq war policy. They also were addressing some of the critical features of the economy, which maybe didn't provide all the solutions, but were willing to admit to their voting constituency that we were in a major crisis, and they were running for Congress to do something about it. So what you had coming in November were people who were formerly town sheriff, people who were formerly high school teachers, who came in with an idea that we were going to change the government, we were going to change the policy, we were going to work on creating a new agenda for the United States and world policy. We're going to fight to get out of Iraq. We're going to fight to do something about that. And you know, we, shortly after the election, before the inauguration, many of these elected congressmen were at Harvard University for an orientation, a congressional orientation at the Kennedy School of Government. We have a youth movement in Boston, and myself and Marcus, we organize. And we got a chance to go out to the Kennedy School that night and get a chance to meet the new congressmen and talk to them. And it turns out that they were ready to get to work. This was in December, and they couldn't wait till January 4th. And it was a good time. We were talking to them about double impeachment. We were talking to them about their own philosophies about the United States. It was good. But what it demonstrated was that there's a different cast of personalities. And we got a chance to associate ourselves with them in a very big way. And many of them are participating in these webcasts, submitting questions. So what's going on? See, now the Democratic Party, let me back up for 1 second. In January 4th, the Democratic Party in particular came in very strong in holding the administration accountable on the Iraq war intelligence and the whole issue of Halliburton and the economy. And what they began to do was hold a series of oversight hearings and investigations where they were calling in witnesses who are from the military, from the Bush cabinet, and from different layers of government in general to come in and testify in front of these congressional committees so that they can try to clear up a lot of the mess that has otherwise been avoided by the previous Congress, the 109th Congress. Because to be honest, the 109th Congress collapsed. It collapsed the beginning of January 2005, and they never recovered. Because they chose not to go with LaRouche's policy to retool the auto industry. Back in 2005, Lyndon LaRouche wrote a separate report on the issue of a capital budget, urging the U.S. Congress to pass emergency legislation to save the auto plants that were being shut down and to utilize the machine tool capacity to begin to produce the necessary equipment and components that we need for a recovery program for the U.S. economy, the development of infrastructure. Repairing our infrastructure, revitalizing our industries, and producing the necessary materials and components you need for high-speed rail, for power systems, back in 2005. And the Democratic Party collapsed under the pressure of the financiers, Felix Rowatin, who's involved in this hedge fund business with Al Gore, who's also part of the Democratic Leadership Council, which Al Gore is also a part of, along with Joe Lieberman, along with Howard Dean, and others. But what happened after this election in November, like I said, we had a new Congress and a new orientation toward policy. What's going on now is that you have a series of presidential candidates in the U.S. who have begun to make their campaign platform climate change, global warming, who have become impotent in the Senate.
When did you hit that wall?
Like
everything was feeling good. It was November, December, talking to them, January, guns out, and then all of a sudden...
It was right after LaRouche gave this January 11th webcast, because like I said, he issued this report on the lost art of a capital budget, and we had made this a central focus of our organizing in Washington, D.C., and LaRouche had given this webcast, and there was a huge response from the Congress to this thing. The first question was basically quoting the report. And then there were, all of these things are archived on our website, so you can always go back and listen to them. But they usually consist of a question and answer period, and the question and answer period is usually dominated by institutions in Washington, D.C. and around the world. But we got a serious response from the Congress on the question of the capital budget. And shortly after that, we noticed in our work in D.C. that there were a whole lot of environmental organizations that were being deployed to lobby the Congress, specifically on biofuels, but also global warming. It wasn't so intense as it is today, but after what really, this is what I want to get into, what really created the surge in terms of the mass hysteria about global warming was when Al Gore received his Oscar award.
Why did they get him Oscar for again?
For the biggest scientific fraud of the 21st century.
Oh, that's why you got Oscar?
Yeah.
Actually, damn good movie. He didn't really win it himself.
Well,
the movie did.
Yeah.
Sure.
But this created a huge, you know, that this was the first year that the Oscars went green. All of the food was organic. The limousines were run on biofuels.
Yeah, right.
It was a peaceful event. But it really took off after the Oscar awards. This is when like the mass this is where people really started discussing this in a big way. But it wasn't really influenced by any scientific substance. It was issued by Hollywood. So that's what I want to get into, because there's some important things that we still need to draw out. Has anybody heard of Bertrand Russell? You have?
Mm-hmm.
Anybody know anything about Bertrand Russell?
He's evil.
Yeah.
He won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, he did, that's right.
The Nobel Peace of Prize of Literature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a
Yeah, he also has
academic.
A Peace Prize named after him, too.
He what?
He has a Peace Prize named after him, as well.
Okay. Well, I want to get into something that describes this phenomenon that we're dealing with here. This is a quote here from Bertrand Russell. And there's two angles to this that I just want to draw out real quick. It's a book that he wrote called The Impact of Science on Society, where he says here, and it's also, yeah. He says here, Russell, he was also an honorary chairman of an organization called the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which is actually associated with the origins of environmentalism and eugenics. But this is Russell. He says, I think the subject of most importance politically is mass psychology. Its importance has been enormously increased by the growth of modern methods of propaganda. Of these, the most influential is what is called education. Religion plays a part, though a diminishing one. The press, the cinema, and the radio play an increasing part. It may be hoped that in time, anybody, will be able to persuade anybody of anything if he can catch the patient young and is provided by the state with money and equipment. This subject will make great strides when it is taken up by scientists under a scientific dictatorship. The social psychologists of the future will have a number of classes of school children on whom they will try different methods of producing an unshakable conviction that snow is black. Various results will soon be arrived at. First, that the influence of home is obstructive. Second, that not much can be done unless indoctrination begins before the age of 10. And third, that verses set to music and repeatedly intoned are very effective. Fourth, that the opinion that snow is white must be held to show a morbid taste for eccentricity. But I anticipate it is for future scientists to make these maxims precise and discover exactly how much it costs per head to make children believe that snow is black, and how much less it would cost to make them believe it is dark gray.
That's a terrible line, that last one.
Yeah. Although this science will be diligently studied, it will be rigidly confined to the governing class.
That's hella long.
The populace will not be allowed to know how its convictions were generated. When the technique has been perfected, every government that has been in charge of education for a generation will be able to control its subjects securely without the need of armies or policemen. Okay. That is Bertrand Russell. He was also very well known as a very peaceful man. He's against the Vietnam War also. He's the so-called founder of the peace movement. And he's also a guy who wrote an article in a scientific journal calling for nuclear war with the Soviet Union. And he's also a vehement hater of Kepler and Gottfried Leibniz and the United States. So that's Russell. And what Russell represents is he represents a political movement that centered primarily in Britain, that came out of Great Britain. And it evolved out of something which we've recently done a lot of work on up here in Canada, called the British Roundtable. And for those, I would just put it out there. There's in this EIR here, there's an article by one of the organizers from here in Montreal, Rob Ainsworth. It's called The New Environmental Eugenics, Al Gore's Green Genocide. And what it goes through is how the so-called environmental movement was set up and where it came out of. And originally it came out of a political intention to reestablish the hegemony of the British Empire, centered in the British Round Table. There's a personality who was the founder of the Round Table named Cecil Rhodes. And here's a quote from him. In a document he wrote called Confessions of Faith. says, I contend that we are the finest race in the world, and that the more of the world we inhibit, the better it is for the human species, the human race. Just fancy those parts that are at present inhibited by the most despicable specimens of human beings. What an alteration there would be if they were brought under Anglo-Saxon influence. Look again at the extra employment a new country added to our dominion gives. I contend that every acre added to our territory means in the future birth to some more of the English race who would otherwise not be brought into existence. Added to this, the absorption of the greater portion of the world under our rule simply means the end of all wars. At this moment, had we not lost America, I believe we could have stopped the Russian-Turkish war by merely refusing money and supplies. Having these ideas, what scheme could we think of to forward this object? Why should we not form a secret society with but one object, the furtherance of the British Empire and the bringing of the whole uncivilized world under British rule for the recovery of the United States and for making the Anglo-Saxon race but one empire? Africa is still lying ready for us. It is our duty to take it. It is our duty to seize every opportunity of acquiring more territory, and we should keep this one idea steadily before our eyes. The more territory simply means the more Anglo-Saxon race, more of the best, the most human, the most honorable race the world possesses. So he mentioned this secret society, saying that we're going to form a secret society with this objective to increase the hegemony of the British Empire and to establish the Anglo-Saxon race as the predominant race on the planet. We're going to expand our territory so we can expand our race. This is once again, Cecil Rhodes, founder of the British Round Table. And there's a lot that Rob goes into here. But hopefully I can use some of the most explicit quotes just to make sure that you guys are going to read through this article. because what we're dealing with is that same enemy. The same enemy of humanity, really. It's not a particular country per se, but it's an intention. It's a philosophy and a policy that's directed at governing the world population and world governments. And I'm going to show the opposite side of the fence once I get through some of this garbage here. So out of the British Roundtable came a so-called science, a pseudoscience called eugenics. Anybody familiar with that? Eugenics. It's the simple translation from scientific terms is race science. And it's a common term like in biology. But there was something called there was an organization established. The name, the Eugenic Society, and it was chaired by a guy named Julian Huxley. It was part of the Huxley family. Some of you guys may have read Aldous Huxley's book, in high school, Brave New World, where he...
A little bit of alcohol added to the certain fetuses in order to make them work.
Yeah, the similar carries a similar character. Carries a similar character of, like, some of H.G. Wells' novels. But, Julian Huxley was also, I don't know exactly which one of the Huxleys it was, but worked very close with Charles Darwin. And this Thomas Huxley? Yeah, okay. And then it was Thomas. Was it? I'm not actually sure. I don't remember. I had a book that was co-authored by one of the Huxleys and Darwin, but I don't remember which one it was. But they were all sort of intellectuals, and Julian. Yeah, I think Julian was the biologist. Julian Huxley. He set up something called the Eugenics Society, and in 1932 there was a international eugenics conference that was held in New York City, and host of the conference was the Harriman family of Brown Brothers Harriman. This was in 1932 here, and the study of eugenics in the 1920s was really influenced by this Anglo-Saxon outlook, because the idea was that we're going to create a science that proves that the Anglo-Saxon race is a superior species than other races and ethnicities. So what they did, like, for example, the Eugenic Society was some of the reports that they put out consisted of just simple physiological measurements of different people from different races, and they would use the wide hips of the African Americans and the slanted eyes of the Asians, and the big lips of the African Americans, of the Africans, the so-called disproportions of the physiological structure to argue that they were imperfect as a so-called species. That the Anglo species was more of the perfect ideal of a human being. And this was, they had a science, so-called.
It was a scientific consensus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, among organizations like the Ku Klux Klan and things like that. And this actually became a big thing under the Nazis. And it was really sparked. It was sparked in two ways by this conference here, the International Eugenics Conference. Because, like I said, the Harriman family was a co-host.
What's the year?
1932. And the Harriman family was a co-host. The Harriman family later on went, in conjunction with a consortium of other large international banks, to put money into the Nazi regime. But so that's one little thing to keep in mind. But also, there were people.
Who were the actual hosts?
It was set up. It was, let's see. Actually, it doesn't say exactly. I don't have it off the top of my head, and I didn't want to search around for it. But yeah, it didn't say it. Identified some of the people who were there. We talk about this guy named Fairfield Osborne, who's I think his nephew later on organized something called the Conservation Foundation. But I think it was this guy Osborne who gave a speech. Let's see. Yeah, he gave the New York Times covered the speech that he gave at this conference. This guy Fairfield Osborne. It says he was the president of the American Museum of Natural History. And this was excerpts from the speech he gave at the International Eugenics Conference. He says, eugenics aids and encourages the survival and multiplication of the fittest. Indirectly, it would check and discourage the multiplication of the unfitted. As to the latter, the United States alone, in the United States alone, it is widely recognized that there are millions of people who are acting as dragnets or sheet anchors to the progress of the ship of the state. You guys remember what was going on in the United States in 1932?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this was before Roosevelt came into the presidency. The election was in 1933, where FDR became president. So in 32, we were still in the middle of a depression. And this is what this guy Osborne says about that. He says, while some highly competent people are unemployed, the mass of unemployment is among the less competent, who are first selected for suspension. While the few highly competent people are retained, because they are still indispensable. In nature, these less fitted individuals would gradually disappear. But in civilization, we are keeping them in the community in the hopes that in brighter days we may all find employment. This is another instance of humane civilization going directly against the order of nature. And encouraging the survival of the unfittest. Okay, so these people who became the useless eaters of the Nazi regime, also the squatters of the Great Depression, why would society throw off the natural balance of nature by keeping them around? If they're unfit for survival, what authority do we have to try to intervene on Mother Nature's destruction of these squatters, these so-called useless eaters? So also at this conference, there were Nazi race scientists in attendance. And the National Organization of the Federation of Eugenics organization was later passed on to be run by one of these prominent Nazi scientists. His name is Ernst Rüden. But this is what came out of this secret, so-called secret society of the British Round Table. And the funny thing is that once the world was face with the atrocities that were committed under the Nazi regime. For a eugenicist, it was kind of a little bit unpopular to say, well, yeah, I study eugenics. And in the language of one of these, somebody, it slips in my mind who it is, but stated that the word conservation in the British Empire was the term describing the British policies toward India. We're conserving. We're
conserving resources.
Yeah. Wow. Or really any other colony. We're conserving the resources that these dark-skinned people would otherwise be using up and wasting. They don't have industry anyway. They're culturally inferior to have industry or maintain it. So what's the use of their development if they're going to be wasting these resources? It had already been established by the eugenicists that they were intellectually incapable of maintaining this kind of economy or society. But that was the language, conservation. And environmentalism, we're protecting the environment. And this became a big deal. Because when the so-called environmental movement was launched as part, just to give you guys a sense of what this quote is in reference to, that I read from Bertrand Russell, because like I said, he was the honorary chairman of an organization called the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which also was spawned out of the British Roundtable as a post-war operation to maintain the British system in the world. Since it was already established that the United States was capable of reviving itself out of the Depression and defeating the Nazis, the British knew that it was going to be pretty difficult to try to continue to maintain their hegemony in a world that Franklin Roosevelt envisioned to be anti-colonialism. This is something that is pretty important, because not too many people know that Franklin Roosevelt directly confronted Winston Churchill on this question of colonialism. And he said, after the war, there's going to be no more colonies. We're going to use American methods to uplift these backward economies and these backward people. And Winston Churchill said, But our industries have been built on these colonies. Our empire, this is the foundation for our success. And FDR said, no way. We have different views on this question. I agree with you that we've got to do something about fascism. But this colonial system has to go. We are demonstrating the success of the right type of development on our and the effect that it's having on our people. And this was a big disagreement. So after FDR had died, the policy was, well, we've got to somehow get rid of this influence, this hegemony that the United States is having in the world. Because this actually wasn't the first time. It happened a generation before, after the Civil War. And this is what Rhodes is reacting to, where after the Civil War in 1876, at the Centennial Celebration, which was an industrial fair in Philadelphia, commemorating the 100-year birthday of the United States, we had a fair under which all of our industrial technology was on display. And there were leaders from all over the world who attended this event. From Brazil, the King of Brazil was there. Mendeleev from Russia was at this centennial celebration. The great German economist Friedrich List, who was spending time in the United States with Henry Carey, Lincoln's economics advisor during that period, was there. And this was an awesome event. All of the inventions and machines on display at this industrial fair were powered by two humongous steam engines that were providing the power and the energy for all of these other machines and displays. And this provoked a lot of people. And what ended up happening was that the American system of economics, which was represented and embodied by Lincoln and Henry Carey, then began to take influence in Germany, began to influence the policies of Russia and Japan. And and the British had to respond to this. But back to this thing about the CCF. This is if you recognize a generational difference, or I would say a species difference in the outlook of the future, or even intellectual capacity to maintain and develop and communicate ideas between our generation and our parents' generation, the distinction, what defines the different quality of our, the difference between the boomer generation and our generation's ability to create and communicate profound ideas was created by the CCF. Because I would say, I would say, just for the simple fact that I organize out in the streets every day and talk to people, I find that younger people, and it's even more apparent in the youth generation of today, people from 16 to 18, 19, they're more excited about ideas, more excited about talking about ideas, politics. And the young adult generation of about 19 to 35, they're also very excited. Sometimes the debate seems to be clouded a little bit by academic viewpoints, and not so much of a concern about the substance of the reality of what's being discussed. Among the older generation, the baby boomer generation, I find they're a lot more cynical and very hard to inspire, and have a lot of ingrained axioms in the way they think. But that comes directly from the CCF. And Russell's quote just gets to the core of what this organization was all about. But it also had an environmental policy. I'll show you that. Here's Russell in the same book. At present, the population of the world is increasing of about 58,000 per diem. War so far has had no very great effect on this increase. which continued throughout each of the world wars. Wars has hitherto been disappointing in this respect. But perhaps bacteriological war may prove more effective. Not so bad. If a Black Death could spread throughout the world once in every generation, survivors could procreate freely without making the world too full. The state of affairs might be somewhat unpleasant, but what of it?
But what of it? Good ending.
Yeah, so that was these were the figureheads of what shaped the culture of the baby boomer generation. People like Bertrand Russell and H.G. Wells, Aldous Huxley, Darwin, especially among the quote-unquote environmentalists. But what we've got to do is, I mean, we've got to figure this stuff out, but we've also got to have a certain amount of compassion for what we're actually dealing with. Even for people like Al Gore, ironically, because I mean, he is a human being. The problem is that he's become an individual. Same thing as Cheney, who's been used to pursue a policy to control the way people think, to control the political agenda of the world, and really control the circumstances of government, really, because if we've got like the case in the U.S. is key to look at it from a clinical standpoint, because if you've got candidates who are running for president of the United States in the middle of this financial crisis and threat of war, who have disregarded the conditions of their constituents, like what Pascal was going through, this housing bubble, this is crushing people, like literally, with the collapse of the machine tool, like the auto industries, and the collapse of the housing market. This is like destroying people's livelihood. And you have presidential candidates who are going out and making their agenda climate change. And this does have effects on the population. It has effects in the way people think. And it has an effect on the way something like the drive to impeach Cheney, what direction that goes. Because it's a major impediment on the real political fight in the world today. What we need to do, as LaRouche describes, is one, we have to make sure that we save the presidency of the United States. And the first step in that is getting rid of Cheney. If you get Cheney out, then you can show the rest of the world you're serious about peace. And the second thing we have to do is we've got to create a budget, a healthcare budget, so we can get George W. Bush top quality mental care. Give him a nice place to stay, where he can be advised for the rest of his term, and bring in somebody competent, maybe somebody from the Senate, to replace Cheney, who could either advise the White House, or in circumstances like Woodrow Wilson, if George Bush just completely kind of loses his mind, somebody who would be competent in taking up the seat of the presidency. But the main thing of political importance right now is to salvage the U.S. presidency. because again, as it was in 1945, when the war was coming to an end, the only political power in the world that had sovereign authority to establish a new international financial system was the United States. And that's because of what I went through earlier. As opposed to most European nations, well, every European nation, basically under the EU. And I'm not really too sure about the Asian or the Asian economies, the way they function. But Europe right now can't do anything about this financial collapse. Because they do what the banks tell them. They have what's called an independent central banking system, where they don't have national banking systems. The parliament can't issue credit or anything of that sort. They go to central banks. Most of them don't have the intention to aid the requests of the governments. Most of them are right now tied up in perpetuating the financial system from completely blowing out. So we're the United States. And this is where LaRouche becomes a critical figure in U.S. and world politics. We're the United States to proffer to the world the idea of reorganizing this bankrupt financial system and establishing a new Bretton Woods type monetary system, go back to a fixed exchange rate, perform a systemic bankruptcy reorganization over the entire global financial system, and eliminate the debt, the burden of humanity right now that's currently tied up in this financial system. Wipe off the so-called monetary assets of these hedge funds and whatever is just tied up in speculation. Say, for example, in the real estate bubble, all the holdings of these financial companies are going to have to be wiped out. And that's another distinction that people have to understand about the United States. We actually have the authority to do that, to tell the banks, this is what FDR did, to tell the bankers and the financiers, our policy is toward the general welfare. Our Constitution says that we're an institution dedicated to preserving the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. And we can't do that with this financial system. And what we would do is we would tell the banks, this is what we're going to do. We're going to put the system through bankruptcy. You're going to cooperate. We're going to have a policy orientation toward development. We can use your bank for investment in these infrastructure programs if you're willing to cooperate with this. If you're not, you're going to have to take the losses. But the primary concern of our nation state is the general welfare. And this is really what has kept the United States alive till now. The fact that we've been able to continue to go back to this principle, bring it to life when it was necessary. It's actually always necessary, but in the most critical periods, it was the epistemological foundation of the Declaration of Independence and the Federal Constitution that has gotten civilization to where we are today, at least since the United States has been established. This is what we're going to have to do. The government of the United States, the Congress, is going to have to be involved in this. And what LaRouche is saying is, put together you want to do this with the four major superpowers of the world, with Russia, with China, and India, for specific reasons. He goes through in the webcast, he goes through the specific reasons why these four nations. He goes through what they're capable of doing in, t- terms of technological capacity and the role that they play regionally to be a thrust toward the development of Eurasia, essentially. And there are roots of the American system in Canada and Ibero-America, which agreements could be made in the Americas based on the role that the United States is going to play in this. And if you get that kind of alliance against globalization, then the British Empire is no longer going to be able to play the role in the world that they currently play. We could establish a new orientation toward economic development. And that's the issue of the Gore hoax, because with the Congress tied up in this garbage right now, while you know, we've got the British trying to provoke situations in the Middle East. I'm not sure if you guys knew, but there's about four carrier groups in the Persian Gulf right now, U.S. carrier groups, with air capability, the carriers, the ships themselves, they're able to deploy smaller fleets from that. And this is something that we didn't even do in the first Gulf War. We didn't do it because the people advising George Bush knew that you could easily provoke a conflict if we would do that. Now, today, we do have four carrier groups in the Persian Gulf. Now, with this stunt being pulled, and I myself don't understand the full implications of how this thing came about or what's directly involved, if this is being provoked by Britain to try to create the spark, which could ignite something in Iran or not. But there is a capability right now, as Jeff Steinberg, counterintelligence for EIR, mentioned, if somebody sneezes, you can start a war. That's how delicate the situation is in that region today. So with this kind of situation, militarily and politically, but also in terms of the condition of the world financial system, if the Congress right now is not in a position because of Al Gore, and it is Gore specifically that's the problem. It is Gore who's preventing impeachment action toward Cheney from occurring, willfully, actually, through the hedge fund managers, through the networks involved in that. It is Al Gore that is willfully the mule inside the Democratic Party of the British.
It's not IPAC.
Huh?
It's not IPAC.
Huh?
It's not IPAC.
APAC.
Nancy Pelosi.
I know that they do have a certain influence, but I'm not just going to say something off the top of my head about that, because I really don't know the depth and the extent of the influence they do have. But the Democratic Leadership Council is full of the same species as Gore. Felix Rowerton is also part of controlling the Congress. He has a large control over the California congressional delegation, because they mostly get their money from a woman named Dianne Feinstein. She's a California senator. and she's been in the Senate for a long time, since I was a child. I grew up in Los Angeles, so I used to see her campaign ads on television. Her husband is in the hedge fund business. He's closely tied to Roatan. So a lot of the money of the Democratic Party is being controlled by this faction, especially the delegation in California, which is the biggest congressional delegation in the Congress, represented in the U.S. Congress. She's no longer the Speaker of the House, but Barbara Boxer, the President of the U.S. Senate. Now, what position is she elected to, like officially? I know she was Speaker of the House. But now, Barbara Boxer. Slips in my mind politically, but she's. Actually, she is Speaker of the House. Yeah, she is Madam Speaker. That's what they call her. She's the first woman. Yeah, she's Speaker of the House of Representatives, and she's
Pelosi.
Huh?
Pelosi.
Yeah, sorry, Pelosi. Excuse me, Nancy Pelosi, not Boxer. She's the other U.S. Senator. Nancy Pelosi. She's controlled by Felix Roatan. She's the third down from the executive branch in terms of the structure of government. So this is the thing. You got a political operation being run through the financiers. And the other thing that LaRouche mentions, which we have also reports on in EIR, he mentions in this webcast that 80% of the hedge funds are located in the British Cayman Islands, under which an elected governor is appointed by the Queen to oversee. So, you know, if the question is in mind, what's the fight? What's this fight about? Well, the fight still today is between the two major superpowers of the world. Historically, the British Empire and the American system. And we're in a situation where if the Congress is undermined by their own cowardice and stupidity to go along with popular consent about global warming, and to protect Gore, then I don't see a chance. I can't rationalize a scenario where the United States wouldn't be destroyed. Really, if they're unwilling to institute policy in the face of this financial crisis, and they're incapable of doing it. That's one thing. If they don't stop Cheney and his war policy that comes from Britain, Tony Blair and the Fabian government, that's another thing. To which, if we did do that, the U.S. would be discredited. We wouldn't have the relationship to Russia or any other nation. And if you think about what that kind of war would entail in terms of a regional explosion, you can kind of just extrapolate a theorem lattice with different situations and scenarios that don't look too good for humanity. So that's the political fight. I actually had a little bit... I was planning on presenting some different material, which kind of got into some of the real substance of the economics work we're doing. We're developing to teach the U.S. Congress on. But I think I'll end up there. And if there's some questions or somebody wants to bring something up. We could just
How do you go about finding
a discussion?
Hedge funds originally came out.
You can just track their address. Like, they're not... They don't play any real function in the economy. Like, they're not involved in... Like, if a hedge fund were to come up and buy General Motors or Chrysler, they wouldn't. The only role that they would play is as sort of an advisory board for the company, because again, they're not really interested in salvaging industry for the sake of innovation and investing in research and things like that. They're more so interested in gobbling of industries and commodities to claim them as assets. So they wouldn't necessarily become a full embodiment of the company. It would play the role of as a board of advisors to the CEO or whatever. And I guess what we did is just we looked up how many hedge funds there are in the world. There's about 9,000, I think. And we found about 7,000 of them linked to the Cayman Islands. And I don't know if they're planning on, who knows, there could be a secret Moon Mars mission being mobilized for the Cayman Islands with all this investment, but I don't think so. They've also, you guys may have noticed, a few months back, probably a year ago now, the prices of commodities were like skyrocketing, and steel and copper, zinc, the price of oil was close to $100 a barrel, somewhere floating around $80 per barrel. Typically it's relatively fixed at about $20-$25. The price of oil was up to about $80. The price of copper was doubling and tripling within a matter of one financial quarter, which is 3 months. This was being caused because these hedge funds were taking major losses in the auto industry and in real estate, and the only place that they could go was commodities. So they began to invest heavily in the commodities market. One reason was to grab up physical assets that could be claimed as ownership in the event of a catastrophe. But the other thing was also that it's a required asset and resource that's necessary for day-to-day functioning of the world economic system. Yeah, so it literally is like mass insanity on a large scale in terms of what we're dealing with, the political economic situation. But there's a reason to fight. There's a reason to be involved politically right now in what we're doing, because the solution to this crisis is available conceptually, and some of the work we're doing in Congress is organizing the U.S. Congress around ideas that will help them think about legislating. But the real political change is going to come as a result of the way in which the youth generation take up the role of political leadership right now and changing the overall characteristic and mission orientation of our society around the solutions. Like, for example, this idea of a capital budget. I'd like to work with some people on that report sometime to get a grasp of what we can do. Like I said, the solutions are there; they can be presented. But it's fundamentally boils down to whether or not people are willing to act on them politically and make it their own personal responsibility to fight for these ideas. Yeah. So that's kind of what I had to say, at least.
Do you know anything about what's going on, like a little bit more about Kirchner in Argentina, maybe?
Not of today. No.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
No, I just run into a lot of people when describing this system of the American system of economics. It's such a fundamental part of our existence. Why we're even here having this conversation only exists because you've had this battle that isn't really appreciated at all, especially by Canadians, but that is literally the only hope that humanity has in terms of an economic infrastructure that works, that has a future. And when I explain this system, largely there's a bit of a disconnect in terms of how it's a utopian idea, like thinking of people before money, right? Like people are very like, oh, it's a pipe dream, it's a nice idea, we'll live. But I think one of the big things that's very important is that it's being affected right now, like in South America. And I'm not completely proficient on what's going on, but you've got President, like Argentina, which in the 70s had like European education standards, like really a high quality of life, whereby you've had a 25-year imposition of IMF and other free trade-oriented looting policies upon that nation, where they could not get out of these conditionalities, and really just destroying them and just sucking them dry. And then, so I mean, they were living as a third world nation until 2003, and then you had Kirchner, this guy come in, who broke away completely from everything that had been imposed upon them up until that point, and literally gave a big up to the IMF, started nationalizing the industries, putting massive amounts of money, like bringing about these principles of the American system of economics into that culture, and putting the people like raising the standard of education, the funding to teachers, and just the quality of life has risen exponentially since then, and the productivity and everything. I mean, this is like the stepping stone or the platform that we have to look at in terms of a successful modern day example of this breakaway from people who say that, all right, it's inevitable or globalization, all the stuff, like, you can't get off it, but here you go, you got this, Ecuador, and these nations are all getting together under these principles, which, 4 years later, it works, and it's doable. It's just a matter of inspiration, really.
That's actually how I think it's successful down there. This President's Club.
Mm.
You know, that's what they call it. It's like a club. They all hang out together, talk about policies. But really, I mean, when LaRouche talks about investing in of the planet, he's talking about continental development, where each region of the world is taking responsibility for development of their area, right? And in South America, you're seeing that with the different infrastructure proposals. You know, talk about a railroad from Argentina to Venezuela, mm-hmm. and all points in between. You're talking about, you know, Venezuela helping Argentina save its you know, its dairy industry down there that was going to be gobbled up by Soros and these guys. And just the level of development down there is at a point where I think it could only be effective if you have the President's Club, because each nation down there isn't really a developed nation to the point where they can just demand that the IMF just completely get the hell out of their country. You had to have Lula, you had to have Kirchner, and you had to have, you know, Hugo Chavez get together and say, hey guys, you know, this is where we're taking our region of the world, and here's what we owe you. Now get out of here. It's also still fragile without the United States cooperation in this whole thing, too, because if this financial system does indeed go down, those nations won't survive either.
Yeah.
And you're talking about, you know, assassination attempts after that. The Kirchner, he's already been targeted once already.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It is this idea of culture that you were getting at, that's going to play a big part in what the youth are trying to do, because we have youth down there in South America as well, up here in Canada. I mean, in a sense, the change has to occur in the United States, but that doesn't make the job that Canada plays, or, you know, Ibero-American countries play even less. Because if you're talking about having a dialogue of civilizations, what type of dialogue is that going to be? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, well, like, you mean, like, in Canada, too, like, I guess the potentials that I really think are vital. Like, Canada, we've got so many things working for us and against us on one hand. Like, you know, you've got, if things don't change in America, whereas the only place they can change at 180 degrees is because of the Constitution. But, I mean, just knowing all these potentials around the world that are things that we can use to, jump off of. But, I mean, Canada, too, we have, like, great, amazing things that America doesn't even have in terms of when, if you get a ball rolling at a certain point, you know, we have a national banking system. So if we have a window of opportunity to use that and implement that could be used immediately, broke away from the privately run banking systems otherwise that control the money. I mean, you've got a whole wealth of resources and potentials here too, and, you know, it's just a matter of, and then too, I mean, the challenge as well, like what the youth movement in Canada is doing. You know, you see this roundtable, we're part of the Commonwealth in a sense, in a very strong sense. But then, I mean, there's so much activity happening here as well because of that, where you have like that roundtable group, which in Britain, it's now called the Royal Institute for International Affairs. In Canada, it's called the Canadian Institute for International Affairs. And you have massive foreign policy planning and propaganda occurring all the time, all over Montreal, all over Canada, and as a testing ground just for the ideology, where you have all the students concentrated in a small portion of land as a main stepping stone for things like Al Gore's movie and just implementing ideology. So, I mean, we've got to work it out for us here too, in terms of things happening in America. But this is a pivotal spot in the world for change to occur as well. And I guess just getting an idea of these things is pretty good.
Yeah, this. I'll show you guys one thing. You guys have this here? You guys have any of these?
It's an old money in their hand. And you got all of them.
I think I can do this one. I don't have one at home. But this is I don't know if you guys know Lyndon LaRouche has run for president a number of times in the U.S. And he recently ran a campaign in 2004 as a Democratic candidate, pre-candidate. And he put out this report called The Sovereign States of Americas, under which he outlines the historic precedent for the type of dialogue that is going on right now, which was the Monroe Doctrine. He emphasizes that there's a specific quality to the relationships between North America and South America based on the principles of the Monroe Doctrine, because the primary idea, which is was coined by John Quincy Adams, would be to have a foreign policy of community of principle among sovereign nation states, and we would have we would establish our relationship based on that idea. And it was this idea of a community of the Americas. He looked at it from the standpoint of the Americas as a whole, North America and South America, as the equivalent to perhaps Eurasia. And he had the idea that the notion of sovereign nation states cooperating with one another as a community would be the foundation for the development of the Americas as a whole. But that's really what's going on right now in South America, because this President's Club is really, really important, what's going on. And it's even gotten a little bit more serious because of there are new presidents who have, I wouldn't say that they've officially joined, but have become closely associated with the leadership around Kirchner and Lula to a certain extent. Like this woman, Michelle Bachelet, who was elected president of Chile, she actually overthrew this woman. I think it was in 2006, last year, she became president of Chile, overthrowing the regime, the remains of the regime of Pinochet. And her mother was somebody who was disappeared, or somebody very close in her family was disappeared in Operation Condor. So she came in very strong as the president, immediately began to reflect a policy to change what had occurred under Pinochet, to remove some of the conditionalities on Chile of the IMF by saying that we're by putting a limit on how much money they're going to pay them. The same thing recently happened in with the president of Ecuador. I can't remember his name.
Evo Morales. No.
Bolivian president.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name, who he is, but recently elected president of Ecuador, and also came in very strong, reflecting the discussion that was already going on amongst the President's Club. And then the thing on top of that was the election in Mexico, which was a big issue. Bless you. Took place over the summer, actually summer 2006, leading into the fall. And the election was stolen from Andrés Manuel López Obrador. And he did something that hadn't been done here in the United States past two elections. He challenged his opponent. Felipe Calderón. He challenged him because what he was saying, he was calling Calderón the banker's boy. And he was saying that if Calderón would be given the presidency, he would leave Mexico for the banks. So he acted, Manuel López Obrador, he acted by organizing the population of Mexico to come down to the town plaza in Mexico City. It's called the Zócalo. And he initiated a protest, and what he said is that we're going to set up a community here until we get this election fraud fixed up. So there were delegates from all over Mexico representing different states who came in as part of the support for what López Obrador is doing, and for over 2 months, people stood in the Zócalo, in the town square, in tents, and our youth movement was there. We set up a tent right at the feet of the statue of Benito Juarez, and we led the movement to educate the Mexican population that was there in support of what López Obrador was doing. And this report here was a key aspect of that in terms of the economic policies. We were also teaching classes on music and science. And we were singing a lot. We were constantly in contact with people from the López Obrador camp. And we were influencing the policy discussion. And the same thing is going on in a different way, more directly in Argentina with Néstor Kirchner, where our youth movement has continuously intercepted him in his travels around Argentina and directly organizing him on policy specific for the Americas as a whole, specifically around this idea of the New Bretton Woods. And that's largely what's been influencing what he has been doing so far in the role of leadership that he has played. And so what's defining this potential for change really is the fact that you do have a youth movement who's effective politically, and we're having a very similar effect in Europe right now. Like in Denmark recently, for 2 days straight, there were articles written on our rail development policy, considering maglev technology, from the main paper in Denmark, Jyllands-Posten. And this was a result of a mayoral campaign or a provincial campaign that we had run, a member of our youth movement had run in Denmark, where he established this idea of high-speed rail as his platform. And now it's being influenced and discussed. So there is a potential for change, even up here in Canada. I've already seen it this week with what we did to Al Gore. We've gotten a great response. I don't know if you guys knew, but Al Gore spoke at this event last week. Did any of you guys go to this thing? No? Did you hear about it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is a big thing, like 5,000, mostly students there. And this big event, elected officials from Canada who were there. David Suzuki was there, some of the top scientists from Europe and Canada. And Al Gore was also there as the guest of honor. And we were there. We had about six people. Six to 5,000 is a pretty steep ratio. But nonetheless, we were the only ones who had the guts to intervene. we were the only ones who did anything to destabilize Al Gore psychologically and let him know that we're after him, but also to break the tension of the type, I usually don't use this term loosely, but the type of real brainwashing that was going on in this event. Because basically what he did is he reviewed his whole movie again on stage live, and I took the liberty of after the first 10 minutes going up there and confronting him, so I didn't stick around in there too long. but the people who did stay with us at the very end said it was like really psychologically difficult not to like be a victim of just foreign emotion based on this scam that this guy's running. And we intervened. We let him know that we were in the house, and continuously, one by one, our youth movement got up and denounced this guy and try to draw out some of the background of what he's involved in. We obviously got kicked out, but what we began to find out as a result of that is most people now want to find out what the hell's going on. They want to know what we're doing. People are signing up, and to give you a sense of how it doesn't get fully into what. It shows some of the characteristic of what kind of phenomenon this is in terms of like this whole just having Al Gore as the spokesman. Yesterday at Concordia University, we ran into one of the youth leaders, so-called, who took like a lot of responsibility in organizing this event and getting Al Gore into Montreal. And he came by our table and he was going on a tirade about what we did, and our organizers were trying to get him to calm down and think about what we had done and think about why we did it. And it turns out that this guy, from his own mouth, when asked if he was concerned about the truth about what Al Gore is doing, he said, "I don't care about truth." He says, The only thing I care about is that you guys disrupted my event. I organize this event, and you fucking brats, you snuck into the event, and this and that, and you disrupted, and you completely destroyed the night. So, gives you a sense, this guy was one of the main organizers who was part of this organization called Youth Action Montreal. And the theme of this event was less talk, more action. But I don't know, it doesn't make sense. This guy, he's on this ego trip about the fact that we disrupted this event that he organized, and not even thinking about the things that we're bringing up.
Not even a thank you.
Yeah, it took, I guess apparently it took another guy who was hanging around the table to kick him out of there, because we were organizing. I wasn't out there, but I got a report last night. We were out there organizing, and there was a group of people around our book table talking to us while this was happening. And this guy was so outraged and irrational that this other guy, who was a part of another discussion, came up and said, "Hey, look, these guys are talking about science, they're talking about politics. If you don't want to talk about that, get the hell out of here." So, we've generally had a good response from people who, as a result, of what we did. So that's the key. That's where the political change is going to come from. It's the fact that there's a youth movement, and I'll just emphasize a pro American youth movement, which is critical, because you don't want to have a pro British youth movement up here in Canada, because that can get pretty nasty, especially.
Oh
yeah.
Is
that?
CIA.
Yeah.
We've got enough of them already.
They're recruiting right now.
Yeah, well, we see the things that are going on in Germany with these. See, one thing, there's just a lot to go through. But one thing that's going on, this is also reported in EIR. By the way, $25 for a student subscription to EIR Online. Every week, you get this magazine published. And, yeah, you guys should take one home tonight and consider subscribing. But international news, economics, politics from around the world is reported in there. It's like 50 cents a copy a week for a student subscription. Otherwise, it's much more. But our audience right now politically is a young adult generation, 18 to 35, and that's what's key. That's what the key for political change. So we're offering these student subscriptions for a very cheap price. But the thing that we documented in an EIR a couple of weeks ago is that in Germany, there's anti-German movements. And
based on the guilt?
I'm not sure exactly what's driving them. One of them is an anti-fascist movement. It's called the Antifa. Mm. And the other one is actually against Germany. It's called the Anti-Deutsch.
I've seen anti-fascists marching in Toronto, and that was one of the scariest things I've ever seen.
Mm.
So,
anti-fascist.
Oh yeah, die you Nazi scum! They're like walking around saying, "Die you Nazi scum!" And what do they look like? You know, shave their heads and away you go.
Yeah,
it's crazy. This same anger. It's the same anger, right? It's the same.
Yeah, we call me anti-Papa.
What's this Holocaust thing? Holocaust religion, new religion, Holocaust.
I'm not sure.
Holocaust deniers.
Deniers? Yeah, I don't know.
What they are talking so often, and too many people are jumping. Looks like they are trying to create another religion, another way of belief, a system of belief. Mm-hmm. What really happened? What really happened?
What do you mean?
Why some people are denying it, and why some
know.
People are so?
I'm not really
well,
sure.
It's like what Jerry was.
Did this really happen? Because none of us were born at the time, you know.
Well, that's like
Holocaust?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's like asking, did we really go to the moon?
We didn't. Not then. Not at that time. Later on.
Yeah.
They didn't even have no rockets at that time.
Yeah, right. No,
the Russians had their Mirage, and they were freaking.
But in general, like the question, like what I try to do tonight, the way I try to present the material that we pulled together, this dossier behind Gore and British controllers and why environmentalism. I try to take it from the standpoint that from like we're living in history right now. Like, I didn't want to like be an academic and just kind of present some facts and make some connectos and things like that. But I tried to situate it, because it is grounded. It is where we are today politically and historically is grounded in what we're presenting. So, I mean, I would say just. Yeah, it did happen.
Not to that scale, the show.
Huh?
Not to that scale, like 6 million people died?
Perhaps more, I don't know.
But why some people are denying it?
I do not know why. I don't know why people See, I'm just not sure what...
Even Chancellor Helmut Kohl, right? Schroeder, too. Schroeder also, last Chancellor.
Mm-hmm. Well,
they denied. And the guy who denied first, I think he's in jail. What's his name, the British journalist?
I don't know his name.
He's in jail right now. Nobody in Europe, nobody can open their mouth against it.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I don't know.
There's this, I mean, I think that the problem, we always talk that, but the question is also you gotta be aware that a lot of, you know, what's going around Israel today is you have some sane faction there, and you have some people who just try to again and again bring back the thing that the Jews have been murdered and all that, which is, it's true, you know, it's true. Hitler was, he happened to exist, right? That's a fact, we know, it's true. Now, but you're gonna have people who are gonna stick on that to just basically stay in the past and not go forward and not do anything else, and, you know, and that's what's the anti-Deutsche movement is right now. They are saying that basically in German blood you have some kind of anti-Semite or in your genes you have anti-Semitism, which is just grounded there. And you know, you gotta keep the German down if you don't want, you know, a new Hitler to arise and kill
funny
more.
It parallels
so
anti-industrialism.
Yeah, of course.
Germans are some of the best industrialists going.
Yeah. So, but basically, that's the question is, well, now, how do we see ourselves in history? What should we do about these things? You know, how do you really understand history if you're not trying to actually act on it? If you're not actually, you know, in the game, in a sense. If you're just a spectator, can you really understand what all these guys are saying? Because sometimes, like Al Gore, you know, if you don't try to go beyond what he's saying, well, you're probably gonna, like a lot of people today, you're probably gonna just buy it because you don't really know. He looks good, you know. He sounds funny, but you know, you gotta figure out, well, what's true about it. And that does the same thing with everything, with science, with you know, music, with economics. You gotta figure out. But you can't just analyze it in a box. That's the thing. That's why we organize, right? And people sometimes come up at us and they say, well, how can you say that? How can you say this? Well, we organize a population. You have a better sense of what people are thinking, and a lot of people, because we're there intervening on Al Gore, intervening on the political situation. So I would say, for, you know, knowing history, that it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. But other
ideas. So that's why they are demeaning it.
Hmm?
Redeeming. That's what they're doing right now?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what they are, but I do know we uncovered an interesting, we're actually pretty, we have a pamphlet that's being circulated in Germany right now. It's in German. If you read German, you can get it off of our website. But it goes through how the hedge funds have begun to use these radical groups, the Antifa and the Anti-Deutschen, as their foot soldiers. In terms of running, like, for example, we've been specifically targeted by the Antifa as a political operation against us, and it's being funded out of some of the hedge funds in Germany. So that's why I was saying it's for the world right now. It's critical to understand what the American system of political economy is all about. Because what it does, see, I don't know, have you guys ever read the Declaration of Independence at all? No. Because it's right there. Let's pull it up, we can read it right now. Because the principles, there's no other constitutional system, right?
Is it just on the black?
That's strange. It's so well known.
Next year, I don't know.
Oh, that'll do it.
It's because you press the blank button on the
probably.
The,
you have
the controller.
The blank button.
Blank. Oh, is it?
It says blank. Yeah.
You see that? It's a square.
Oh, jeez. Okay, what's going on here?
That's got to be good.
That's not
good.
It's here.
That's not. I wouldn't say so.
I don't know.
No, it's okay. When you have a problem with the window.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely bad.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know.
Sorry.
I had a sort of thing last night. That's a screen of death. That's
really? Are you serious?
It's just when you...
Is that a bad joke or what?
When this happened to me last year, that my computer, my hard drive...
Started.
Correct.
Really?
Yes.
Is this my laptop?
Yeah, it's yours. No, it's mine.
Okay,
it's mine.
Good. All right.
No, it's just...
When you see that, it's
mine. Okay. All right.
Somebody want to read it?
I did somewhere on my laptop?
No, I was just going to pull it up off the website.
It's not connected though.
What happened to your friend?
They had other things to do, so
I'll keep
bugging. Don't worry.
Okay. Did you get the EIR?
The what, sir?
The EIR.
Yeah, I got one of them. So.
Alright.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah.
That's in the EIR.
That's in the EIR.
Oh, I thought you were going to read. Yeah, that's right.
I came last few times in Nantia, but we were in Washington.
Yeah, I'm from Boston. So.
You are from the States, aren't you?
Yeah.
From
the
States.
Do you want to read that?
Yes.
I was asking if somebody wanted to read it right now.
You can get it
online.
Okay.
If you want.
Yeah. Are you studying there?
Yeah, it's
undergrad.
Yeah, I don't have any with me right now.
Undergrad.
Yeah,
undergrad. Yeah, so okay. I already have a graduate degree right now.
Have you ever read the Declaration?
No. I would love to. If I could get it online, I would go through it again.
It's pretty
short.
Yeah.
I was born in that.
Like the Declaration is longer, but it's just like the
I think my brother died.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
I think I've said
it's about the
human dignity or equality or something like that.
There's this principle, that all men are
pretty
equal.
This is a pretty established publication.
That's basically why they separate from
basically
the British.
The way we produce our intelligence.
Because what do they have?
Pascal was saying through the work that we're doing politically.
Well, that's the Declaration of Independence.
The issue
of constitution also
statement as press release of the
Constitution,
all forums and events,
major document.
Like what LaRouche describes as
constitutional.
An approach to intelligence work is you see something
the
in
Constitution
you find out what it is
until
you poke
1789.
So we're constantly poking at the international
we declared independence
leaders
in
1776.
So in between those
pulled together
that
in a whole,
that was what the debate of what the Constitution was going to be.
So what we do, we grab
form
the whole international bureau.
We had even arguments from people that, you know, we should establish a monarchy. So this was heavily
favored.
Yeah.
One of the contributors to EIR, he's recently published a series of articles on the situation in India. Because there right now, India is tied up with China and Russia right now.
I have it in my bag.
For example, Russia, Putin just announced that they're going to build four nuclear power reactors in India simultaneously. Well, LaRouche discusses in there.
How do you turn this thing off right here?
Is it on?
Yeah.